Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets rising into the end of the year. Investors sloughing off impeachment. Fed on hold through 2020. Tax changes for retirement plans coming. All this and much more on episode number 641 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hey there. This is Andrew Horowitz, and I am the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast and founder of Horowitz & Company. And for those of you that are not maybe totally sure and exactly understand what we do, well, let me give you just a couple of quick insights to start off the show this week into the end of the year. Because I want to let you know that Horowitz & Company is an investment advisory firm, and we work with individuals and companies on managing portfolios. We have a range of strategies that are designed pretty much to fit, essentially any need of an investor, risk tolerance, their time horizon. And maybe it's not for everybody, but we do have a range of different risk and styled portfolios. We have the global allocations, which are more of a traditional type of investing with macro overlays. We do a global diversification using institutional mutual funds and ETFs. And similar to that is our Investology platform. This is our advisor-crafted, technology-enhanced, robo-esque style offering. Minimums down to $10,000 on that. You asked us for that a couple of years back, and we put that into play for you. It's similar to the global allocations, where we have a range of risk factors and time horizons that we match up. But this is done through a questionnaire. Investology is that style where you help input all the information online and we create a portfolio for you on the fly. And you can play around with it. You can go back and forth and change a few things. And then once you're ready, well, we invest with that. And what we do with both of those portfolios is we spend a good amount of time looking at a blend of assets that are diversified using what's called modern portfolio theory. Creating a balance, creating a diversification that is in line with all the different components of what you're looking for. And what we look at there is, you've heard me talk about this before, is the concept of a flower garden. So let me explain what that means. So if you have a flower garden and essentially you have just impatiens in there, they're going to look great during certain times of the year, right? They're going to look, just gorgeous with colors ranging from pinks and purples and blues and whites, also reds, all sorts of different colors that are going to be popping up during the season. But once that season ends and when you no longer have that going on, where you have the opportunity to have maybe an artificial flower blooming, the fact of the matter is that you're just going to have a lot of weeds and dirt and nothing there. But if you add to that garden evergreens and roses and heliconia and just a whole host of other types of flowers and bushes, something's going to be blossoming every season. Something's going to be popping up and looking pretty good all the time. That's the whole idea of what we're trying to do. We pick out the weeds, we rebalance, and we have that flower garden diversified in such a way that even when a cold snap comes, something is still going to hopefully be blossoming and looking good. And then beyond that, we also have a long-short strategy. This kind of rounds out the whole package. We call it the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. And we use this for clients primarily as a style diversifier. Because most people pretty much have only the long style, long-only portfolios. And when you blend different investment styles with core equities like we do, built on a quant screen, short positioning, hedging, day and swing trading, what you do is offset some of the risk that you have potentially in a non-correlated or an uncorrelated asset as compared to your long-only portfolio. So if you're thinking about having your portfolio managed and you like our style and our outlook and what we talk about each and every week on the show, check out more on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can schedule a time to talk to me personally on what may be the best for you, do a portfolio review to see how you're situated. So I think that kind of, I want to get that out to you because some people always ask me to give a little bit more color and detail on what we exactly do, aside from, of course, this and DH Unplugged podcasts. And before we go any further, I want to also mention, because it is the holiday week, getting in the holiday spirit, a happy Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, a Merry Christmas to all. And I want to wish you, before we go any further, a wonderful year coming up. So we're going to talk about some of the things that are going on in the markets. And I have a couple other goodies I want to kind of go through with you today in this discussion. I think the obvious thing we need to start with is the obvious movement of the markets creeping higher into the end of the year as we're seeing that so many things are starting to come together. And a lot of people have been asking, like, what is going on? Why are we seeing markets continually moving higher and this incredible move throughout the end of the year from September through December? Pretty much a mirror opposite of what we saw last year. We talked about this a little bit on the DH Unplugged show, John C. Dvorak and myself. We talked about this and we tried to break this down to understand what exactly is happening. And I think what we really came to the agreement of, and what I'm seeing, is that we are now having a host of items resolve. We're seeing resolutions to many of the headwinds that were presenting themselves over the past several months. And if you think about all the things that people were concerned about and what was going on with markets and how there was this back and forth concern about, you know, all these issues that were at hand, and how over the last couple of months, now all of a sudden we're seeing this resolution happen for each and every one of them, at least giving us some more clarity. And the uncertainty now has been taken out of the markets. And you know, one of the things that markets hate, despise, can't deal with at all, is the whole idea of uncertainty. So let's go down the list and talk a little bit about some of these things and give us, I think, a better insight as to why we're seeing what we're seeing. So the first thing I think is Brexit. Now, with the latest gyration of this, which we've seen for the past 2.5, 3 years or so, however long it's going on right now, with the back and forth and whether we're going to have a hard Brexit, no Brexit, some Brexit, split off Brexit, there seems to be a resolution now that Boris Johnson is giving a definitive date to the end of all this. January 31st is the D-Day, the Brexit day, we think. Well, I mean, at least that's what they're telling us. Could there be another delay, a change of heart? Possibly. But it does look like, from what we're seeing, from what we're being told, if we can believe that or not, but let's just go with the idea that, yeah, we're going to believe what's being said right now, that Brexit is at least going to be resolved and whatever's going to happen is going to happen. We don't have to worry anymore. There's a lot more clarity here. So that's one thing that's kind of somewhat off of the table. Then we have the USMCA, or the new NAFTA. It looks like it's done. They voted on it, passed it off, or at least close to getting it done. And even though there's some potential holdup for this whole shenanigans going on with the impeachment, and maybe it's not going to be voted on, finalized in the Senate until the impeachment is completed. Now the Senate is holding, the House is holding off sending in the information from the Senate because Pelosi wants to get clarity on the process. And McConnell said that the USMCA is only going to be voted on. We do know one thing, that the final bill is ready to be signed. We know what's in it. There's clarity on that. There's a resolution on this. No longer do we have to worry about what ifs. Is it going to be signed? Is it going to be signed? And now you can actually do some proper planning around that. Now you know what you have to know. So that's the second thing that pretty much is done. Now, whether you agree with what was done or not, it's not the point. The point is that we're beyond the point of worrying about what will be the components. if we have the information and we understand what is outlined in the plan, then we can do proper planning and move on. Now, a little bit into, is this resolved? And the question, is this resolved or isn't this resolved? We have to talk about the partial, skinny, phase one trade deal with China. Now, as it's explained to us and as we're being told, this is a done deal. Done. Ready for signature, whenever that happens. The only thing we need to do now is start working on phase two. And now we're hearing that there's possibly going to be phase 2A, 2B, maybe even 2C. And even though there is some uncertainty around that, the idea is that if every side is saying that now we have a completed phase one deal, which maybe be just a simple ceasefire. Because the truth is not much that's changed here. But the belief that's being propagated is that it's a big move forward. And yes, maybe they're only buying some agricultural products, and maybe the U.S. is going to drop some of the tariffs and not raise some of the tariffs that were supposed to be added a couple of weeks back or a week back. The fact is that everybody is talking about how, yeah, we have a deal done. And that brings some satisfaction to markets. Not so much that everybody's cheering for what's inside of it, because the truth of the matter is nobody has seen the details. We have no idea what's really inside of this deal. There's talk about $40 or $50 billion of agricultural products being bought and another $150 billion of other products being bought by China. There's some talks about protection for at least a small amount of protection for IP theft. There's some talk about some other components of here and dropping of some tariffs and maybe looking to move tariffs even lower over time. But again, it doesn't seem like anything's in writing, nor do we see that we have any of the details, nor do we see that either side has really agreed to what the other side believes is inside of this deal. But nonetheless, both sides are saying that something is done. Now, stepping back a second, between you and me, I think it's a bunch of malarkey. Stealing a phrase from Joe, I think what they're doing is just simply trying to appease markets. And yes, when I say markets, not anything more than stock markets, in the desire to make it look like something's happening and behind the scenes still negotiating the deal. Even if the trade one, phase one, partial skinny deal was done, in so much as it's just simply further agricultural products and a ceasefire on any new tariffs, we have already heard that the tariffs that are currently in place are going to be used as leverage points for the next phase, which is much harder because these are the items that were taken out of any kind of deal that couldn't be decided upon and agreed upon by either side. So here we are, markets saying, well, at least we didn't get the increase in tariffs, and it looks like the two sides are talking. So you know what? We're going to be happy about that, and we're going to bid up markets like as if all tariffs have been removed. The trade issues that were major problems have been resolved. And we're good with that until we hear otherwise. Until we hear that there's something that's going on that may not be in line with what we're creating as the narrative of the trade deal. We'll just go along and continue to bid up stocks, bid up risk assets, like this thing is moving along just beautifully. So again, there may be a differential between reality and the narratives that are being presented. But the narratives that are being presented are the ones that investors are grabbing onto with both hands and buying stocks. Last week was the biggest inflow into equity mutual funds and ETFs after massive outflows throughout the year by individuals. A major turnaround, I think $130 billion were pumped into equity mutual funds and ETFs last week. When we've had a net $125, $130 billion out. I have to check that number exactly, but I know that there has been a net outflow throughout the entire year, and all of a sudden last week when we proclaimed that we have a resolution and we have a deal done, absolutely done, just awaiting a signature, which again, we haven't seen anything on paper yet because there is nothing on paper. But everybody got excited and probably was holding off and saying, you know, I'm not investing until I gain clarity. So now the clarity is that we have a trade deal, when in fact, it's just a backing off of certain aspects of the tariffs and possibly, maybe, going back to the levels that we had a couple of years back before this whole thing started with agricultural and other purchases by China of U.S. goods. So again, it's all a matter of confidence. How many times have we talked about the idea that the entire market is a gigantic confidence game? You can have great earnings and you can have, you know, good outlook, good economics, but if there's something on the horizon that's very concerning and confidence breaks by the individual and by investors in totality, you're going to have a problem. You're going to have a big sell-off. You could have horrible numbers across the board. But if there's something in the future that looks bright, investors have confidence. Maybe it's their job that's very secure, or they're getting a job, or maybe it's a bonus they got. Who knows what it is? If there's confidence by the investor, markets will do well. And that's what all this is about. It's all about cleaning up all the uncertainty that's been out there and circulating for so much time, while, by the way, on the side, probably bringing a lot more uncertainty to other matters, but at least cleaning these up before we get into another mess on the next part of the negotiation of the trade deal, on the question of whether or not, well, is Brexit really going to happen on the 31st? On the USMCA, well, is it really a good deal? Is it going to be a holdup? The next item on the list when we talk about the resolutions and what's happening here, we have to talk about the repo market. The Fed's injected about $400 to $500 billion into the system through their permanent market operations, essentially flushing the banking and the backbone of the financial system with cash. And what they're doing is helping to provide liquidity. And what happens here is that even though those funds are designated to be liquidity for the overnight lending, because they're concerned about the end of the year, end of the month, end of the quarter, where they get a significant amount of potential for treasury bills swapping around, maturing, having to buy more, the banks having to leave a certain amount on deposit with the Fed, but yet they have all these expenses related to end of year tax filings and tax payments they have to make, as well as other things. They want to make sure there is plenty and almost an overage of liquidity and cash in the system, so they don't have what happened in September, where that spike on liquidity, where the overnight lending rate went from, let's say, 1.5 to just about 10% over a two-day period. But we all know that even though the Fed has been pushing this money in, driving their balance sheet from, let's say, $3.7 trillion to about $4.1 trillion right now, and some more money on the way, probably bringing up to $4.2 trillion by the end of the year, that even though they proclaim this is not quantitative easing, that we know it is. It simply is. And quantitative easing, oftentimes, even though the money may be directed for this particular short-term overnight lending market, somehow finds its way into the system, into risk assets, because maybe there's more liquidity in this area, so therefore there's less liquidity required in other areas. And again, where else can you find returns? flushing the system with liquidity was one of the ways that they felt could really bring on better jobs, better economic growth. Obviously, the wealth effect and risk assets being bought and confidence in the system. So again, what they're doing is essentially flushing this money in, providing for the confidence. And you can see almost a direct correlation between how much money and when they put money into the markets, and again, into the repo markets in this case, and what the equity markets have done. Now, are they ever going to start draining the system of this once they get past the end of the year? I would say probably not. Because the Fed has been the architect of this incredible move in 2019. If we blame the Fed for the fall of the markets at the end of 2018, that swoon that we saw in November that pretty much hit the low point on Christmas Eve on the 24th of December 2018, because of their automatic program to continue on raising rates because they felt the economy was in pretty good shape. And stick with the belief that the Fed is a pretty good economist. I can't even say that with a straight face. But the Fed is a pretty good economist. They can see things that we can't. Well, if that was the case, they wouldn't have been increasing rates as quickly and in that automatic process that they were doing. But now what we're seeing is that Fed speakers are coming out all over the place and telling markets that they feel that any rate move is pretty much on hold through 2020. Unless there's a significant change in the underlying economics one way or another, they're pretty much sitting on their hands right now. They believe that they are in a good position and somehow, they can see the economic situation through the end of 2020. They couldn't even see the next 2 months back in November of 2018. How can they see something for the entirety of 2020 without the data? Things change. One of the things we know is, of course, that the Fed oftentimes doesn't want to really get involved in any kind of major moves during a presidential election year. So that may have something to do with it. But the fact is they're doing the exact opposite of what they did in 2018 right here towards the end of the year in 2019. In 2018, they said they're pretty much on autopilot. They're going to increase rates. The economy is really good. And they're going to start moving things up. And they don't see any change for some time in their rate levels that are really significant. They're going to be on hold and maybe increase once or twice throughout 2019. Well, that ended quickly as markets threw a tantrum, you know, down into correction plus territory into the end of the year. Major swoon as markets said, wait a minute, if we're going to increase rates and keep on doing that, that's going to curtail the share buybacks that are going on. It's going to cost companies money. It's going to be much more draining on the economy. And again, within a quick 2 or 3 week period, they had to change that all around and talk about how they're on now no longer an automatic rate increase, but they're seeing some different things in the markets all of a sudden, and they have to start reducing rates. This is not clarity. This is not an economist who has the ability to see the future. Why they think that we're going to believe that they could see throughout the entire 2020 and probably not have any change in their current status is beyond anybody's understanding. However, what they're trying to do here is very simple. They're trying to portray that they are going to be much more on the stimulus side of the equation, and that if any bad news comes in, realize that they're there to do something to hold up the back end of markets and in the economy. If we start getting better news, well, they're going to allow for things to overshoot. They talked already about their change in how they're going to calculate their assumption of interest rates related to inflation. As one of their main mandates, They're talking about this 2% rate that they talked about forever, right? Well, now they say, you know, well, if we hit 2%, it may be okay if we go past that for a while. Let's say we go to 2.5%. Well, if we look back and we see that we've been at 1.5% for some time, we can average that over, let's say, a two-year period. And if we're at 1.5% for a while, and then we shoot up to 2.5% and we look at it, it's probably right within our 2% target rate. So we're going to do this inflation targeting with an averaging process, allowing for the Fed to move the economy into a hot zone and keep their rates very low, keep their balance sheet very high, not worrying about the drag on the economy that excess debt has, the velocity of money when they're actually slowing down rates, the potential for further deflationary pressures due to the fact that as rates go down, people may hold off a little while because prices aren't moving so much. Because what we have found, I think definitively, is the Fed and central banks around the world cannot control inflation. Yes, they may be able to hold off increases in inflation as they raise rates, but lowering rates, even down to the negative rate zone, hasn't caused inflation in Japan or in Europe. So what makes anybody think that the Fed's dropping interest rates are actually going to bring inflation back to their 2% target? Makes no sense. But being central banks, they'll continue doing what they do on a regular basis. And in the end, what's the impact? Well, once we said this again, it's a move on risk assets. And you could take that to the real estate markets. You can look at stocks, bonds, gold. Look at this year. Almost every asset class and some of the best markets around the world are those that are in the most miserable shape. Greece is one of the best performers this year. Venezuela, amazing performer. You look at the list of countries that are in economic ruin. Some of the stock markets are doing just fantastic. Because risk is back. Risk is in the markets. So I think as we get towards the close of 2019, it appears that there's, well, not much to worry about, right? At least that's what's being promoted. Even the continuing slowdown in China and Europe has a new narrative that they're now trying to bring out. It's a programming process by the powers that are trying to shape confidence. Now what they're calling it is a bottoming process. Yeah, we're seeing a bottoming process. You'll see this. Just put this in the back of your head and just remember this as you watch some of the financial programs. You're going to start seeing a lot of people talking about the bottoming process. Yeah, they'll say something like, you know, we see that Europe has been slowing down and Germany clearly has been moving into a recessionary, but it looks like from what we could see here, it's a bottoming process. They're getting towards the bottom. What is this like? What does this remind you of? It reminds me of Bernanke's green shoots, right? Where the bottom may be in, which means that everyone will get, you know, and everybody will think that things are going to get better from here. So you might as well jump on board. And with that, we still have pretty much every single central bank, Mexico again, 25 basis point drop last week. Every central bank around the world is continuing to lower interest rates. So what we have now is low rates, limited headwinds, and pretty much a bottoming process going on. That sets you up as an investor. It's kind of like red meat for the investor. Like, whoa, think about that. We got a Fed that's on hold and very stimulus oriented. We have central banks around the world that are not thinking about anything more than just pushing more stimulus into the system through either quantitative easing or lower interest rates. We're seeing a bottoming process go on, corporate profits holding up, and those things that were headwinds for corporate profits starting to resolve. The big one being the trade deal that was possibly going to squeeze margins on many companies, which I haven't, we've seen some, we've definitely seen some. But those companies that were most vulnerable to the tariffs, maybe they become good buys now. Maybe they're oversold by a dramatic amount and we're going to see a resurgence. And what we have found is that, yeah, people are buying those most risky assets. At the same time, though, corporate balance sheets are bloated with debt. We know that. As a matter of fact, we now have confirmation that the debt load on the corporate balance sheets are the highest on records. The highest. And why they're doing this is that they're utilizing a lot of this for corporate buybacks, which is estimated to be another $400 billion in buybacks in 2020. And we know how much of an effect that those buybacks have had on markets. So we can say that there is one of the, we'll say the legs in the stool. Look at things like retail investors and hedge funds, institutions, and corporate buybacks as being the three legs on a stool. We know one of those is pretty solid for 2020. At least as long as rates stay down, borrowing continues, and we have, you know, a decent outlook for markets. Debt of sovereign nations is the highest level also ever, with no sign of coming down anytime soon. We have valuations that are stretched in the U.S. and tariffs still in force for the most part. Earnings season's pretty much going to be something to watch because it may be hard to justify these valuations, especially with the run that we saw recently. Now, there may be some better outlook, but margins are not going to change, and there's probably still compressing for a lot of companies as tariffs are still in place. And even though interest rates are low, and even though while the corporate debt is at a record, the loan servicing that's going on right now, the debt servicing on that is pretty much at the same levels that we had. Because, of course, remember, I don't know, let's go 10 years ago or something. You had a 4% interest rate and let's say $1 million of loans on your books. Now you have $2 million of loan on the book at 2%. So you're paying the same amount of money. The problem comes in when you have to pay these all back. And sometime in the future, what's going to happen is rates will be higher than they are today. The refinancing of that debt will be extraordinary unless it's paid off. So what is really happening is that many returns are being pulled forward right now in terms of market returns because companies are so short-sighted, looking from quarter to quarter at what their earnings are. They need to boost their EPS. And one of the ways to do that is through financial engineering. And how do you do that? Well, you do share buybacks. Well, how do you do that? Well, you get money from the, you know, from loans, short-term, long-term loans, and you buy back your shares. So that is the bottom line to all this and why the Fed is so absolute at keeping rates so low. They know that there could be a major problem coming if companies need to refinance and sovereign wealth and sovereignties need to refinance at higher rates. As we have economic data continuing to slow here and abroad, they have a bit of a shield and a bit of a backing in place where they can say, well, you know, we see that things are slowing down, so it makes sense to reduce rates. But really what they're doing is ensuring that this whole machine continues to get greased pretty well because risk assets falling, of course, oftentimes will help lead into a recessionary period. So this economic data that we're seeing really slow down hasn't had much of an impact on earnings, even though we are seeing quarter by quarter, year over year earnings in the negative growth area. One of the things we're seeing is the multiple expansion. And multiple expansion that is seen primarily due to lower interest rates. If there are no further rate cuts that are going to be in order, I mean, what's the next catalyst that we have to look for moving prices higher? Is it going to be another phase one deal that got done? Hey, we got it done again. Because on Friday, there was more news about, hey, the phase one deal looks like it's going to get signed. Like, that is another piece of news that is going to move markets higher. But that's what they're banking on. They're banking on continually and slowly and surely leaking out and putting out this news that's going to help to support markets. So I guess what we have to agree on is going to be a pretty interesting year upcoming as we have elections on tap, along with, well, hopefully, the next phase of a trade deal, probably with several countries. Already talking about increasing tariffs in Europe on major goods, particularly from France, 100% increase of tariffs on 100% of the good, or 100% tariffs on their goods, which is pretty substantial. So the question now, as we go through all of this, right? We went through all the resolutions that are starting to fall and put, you know, line up in place, I guess is the right way to say it. And then we look at some of the question marks that are out there about interest rates, the Fed, what they're going to do, about corporate debt, about the amount of economic growth or lack of growth that we have. The question is, what are you doing about all this? What are you doing about all these things? Are you just saying, you know what? Okay, markets have been good to me for the last several years. I'm not doing anything. That's a reasonable thing, depending on your age, your time horizon, your risk factors and all that. But have you even thought about it? Have you thought about making any changes into your portfolio, or are you just like lazily saying, I'm just going to sit tight? Because I think right now where we are, exactly a couple of weeks before the end of the year, it's a good time to think about the end of the year. We'll be looking to make valuation adjustments to the portfolio if needed. We're going to do so. We've been looking into this. We're looking at client portfolios into 2020 saying, you know what? Some of these valuations in some of these sectors are a little bit off kilter, too hot. Why don't we start rebalancing the gains that we had from those sectors into other sectors that may benefit in a changing landscape? And the several areas that we're looking at that may really be ripe for a rotation, both in and out of. So again, what are you doing? If you're going to say, well, I don't do anything. I just kind of, I don't know, my portfolio, look at it once every 6 months. I'm not doing anything with it. That may be really good and a good way to view long-term investing money if you're in your 20s, maybe even in your 30s. As you start getting into your 40s and 50s, and that ultimate date of retirement is starting to stare you right in the face, and you're thinking, hey, you know what? I have a limited time here. Maybe I should start paying attention. Well, lo and behold, here we are entering into the end of the year, towards the new year, time to make resolutions. And why not make some resolutions that are related to your finances? Financial resolutions for 2020. I'd like you to think about that. As I say, try that on. It's time to maybe spend some time thinking about, what's my plan? Do I have a plan? Because they say, you know, failing to plan is planning to fail. You've heard that. And I think it's important to understand that you need a roadmap. Because if you don't have a roadmap and you're traveling down the road, where are you going to? You're going to wander aimlessly throughout the desert till you get to your final destination, if you ever get there, before running out of gas. So you need a roadmap, a way to ensure that you are on the right path to your destination. Not just haphazardly going and stopping and starting and starting again and hoping for the best that maybe we'll get there. It looks like it's over there. I think it's over there. You know what? Let's go over there. Let's go. Well, it's not exactly over there. You know, in fact, not only is it not over there, but there's no road to get to that part. Maybe we should back up, stop for a second, and readjust. You know, hey, Siri, I need directions to home. No, we're talking about here. Hey, Siri, I need directions to financial independence. I mean, that's what we're talking about. We need a roadmap. You need it. Write it down. Adjust it annually and look at the current conditions. Look at, you know, changes in the markets, changes in the environment, because we know that everything cycles. If there's anything that we do know is that the economic cycle is not necessarily broken and it's not solved. Okay? It's not what I'm saying about this is that even though the Fed would like to portray the idea that there is this economic cycle, you know, the peak to the trough, to the recovery, to the upside and to the peak again, and maybe an overshoot back down to tapering off a bit back to trough. Well, they say, well, it's no, we've solved that. No longer are we going to go into this trough or recessions. These slowdowns that we've had in the past, thing of the past. We have got this down. They've been saying that forever. There's no such thing. They may elongate and help to maybe temper some of the downside, possibly. But if it's anything that we know, there's one thing that we know for sure. The Fed creates bubbles and they eventually pop. Now, I'm not saying that we're in a bubble right now. I'm just saying that that's what happens. They allow things to get out of hand like they did this year, in my opinion. They let things go out of control because they don't, for goodness sake, want to see any slowdown and take the blame for that. So you need a plan of action. You need to write it down. Spend a few minutes. A lot of people spend more time deciding what they're going to have for dinner than they do of how they're going to get towards retirement, how they're going to build their financial independence in the future. And now is the time. You have some time off coming. You may be on vacation, maybe on the beach somewhere, maybe just sitting home alone. Spend a few minutes, take out a pad of paper. Where do you want to be? And then we can go backwards and figure out, okay, well, how am I going to get there? What do I want for dinner? Okay, where am I going to order from? Where do I want to be in 10 years, in 15 years, in 25 years? And what's it going to take to get there? Now, if you're smart enough, you could use financial calculators, figure all this out, and then start figuring out, okay, how much money do I need to put aside? What kind of risk should I have in my portfolio? Let's say, let's go to the extreme. So you know what? By all accounts, you have enough money right now to retire. You have enough money to carry you through the next 30 years. And all you need is a 7% rate of return or a 5% rate of return or whatever it is. Knowing that, then you can adjust your portfolio to what historic quote-unquote norms are to reach that level of overall return. And instead of having a portfolio that is 80% of equities in a market that is somewhere towards the upper echelon of where it should be at this point of time, maybe start thinking about alternatives to what you have for stocks. Maybe look at alternative assets. Maybe look at some hard assets. Maybe look at some bonds in there. Or even look at some commodities. Something that maybe is going to buffer some of the downside, because now what you have is a much more restrained time period, much more concentrated time period for recovery. When you're in your 20s and 30s, it's much more logical that you could have a good amount more risk because the recovery time is a lot longer. As you get into your 50s and 60s, your recovery time shrinks. So what I'm saying to you is, this is the time for financial resolutions. All right, putting that aside, I got a couple other important topics I want to talk about as we close up the show this week. And one of the things is a really interesting new development with the new and improved government spending plan that was recently passed, looking like it's going to go for signature and all done, finished. I think it's $1.4 trillion spending bill that is now going to keep the government open. And there's always a little, couple little things inside of there that we got to pay attention to. One of the ones in particular is all the changes that they've made with regard to retirement plans. Now, it's not official what I'm going to talk to you about because we haven't seen the final, but this is what was in the draft. It looks like it's going through. So it will be something like this, if not identical to what I'm going to talk to you about right now. And what they're doing here is looking to raise money inside of the spending bill, changing some of the rules on retirement plans that hasn't been done in over 13 years. We haven't seen any significant changes when it comes to retirement plans. Let me run through this for you because you're going to have to know some of this moving forward. Probably the biggest and I would say the most interesting change is related to inherited IRAs. Inherited IRAs, both traditional and Roth, used to be where a non-spouse would be inheriting the money and you'd set up an IRA beneficiary account, inherited IRA account. You would basically be able to take out the required minimum distribution over your lifetime, the lifetime of the beneficiary, or depending on when the money was taken out, it would be the lifetime of the beneficiary and possibly a spread number between that and the deceased. And there's a lot of different ways to do it, but basically the new rules are saying that a non-spouse beneficiary will have to take out their IRA over 10 years. So in other words, no more stretching the IRA over lifetime. And that 10 year starts at the date of the original account owner's death. It's estimated that about $15 billion in new tax revenue will be collected over a 10-year period just from this change. So keep aware of that. There's going to be a lot of planning that needs to be done with this moving forward when we see this come into play. So we have to be careful on what beneficiaries are now going to be on IRAs and how that's going to be planned for and the taxation of this in the IRA planning sphere. RMDs, required minimum distributions, will need to start no longer at age 70 and a half, but at age 72. There's another provision that will allow small businesses to join together to offer 401k plans as a group, whereas it may have been cost prohibitive or difficult for a small business to have a 401k plan in the past. Now businesses in certain circumstances can group together. Part-time, another provision, part-time employees will be eligible to access employers' 401k plans. So that makes it easier for them to add on. 529 plans can be used to pay off student loan debt, which is kind of interesting. And you'll also be able to, in IRAs or retirement plans, possibly be able to take out child benefits, up to $5,000 penalty-free for child care costs, like a new baby. So there's some really interesting provisions that are inside of this, that was snuck into this spending bill that you need to be aware of. So I encourage you probably until, let's say, January or definitely when you spend time doing your taxes next year, contact your financial advisor and your CPA and talk to them about what is the new changes, how they impact you. And finally, we're going to close this week with some information. I got a couple of emails on this and a question came in about my first book. What started the TDI podcast, the Disciplined Investor podcast, back in 2007? It was that I wrote a book and publisher said, why don't you start a podcast? And I said, oh, okay. Anyway, the book was and is called The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. And yes, it is available on Amazon and Audible. Makes a great gift for someone you care about. We run through the basics of ways in which you can help yourself or other people understand the elements of quantitative and fundamental analysis, as well as technical analysis, plus a few areas that you'll find interesting about retirement planning and annuities and guaranteed investment contracts. So if you're interested in learning about more about the process and you want to check out that crazy mustache, of course, that I had on for the cover, although for the audiobook, it was taken off. So that's good. But you could go over to any of these places and get yourself a copy of the audiobook of The Disciplined Investor. With that, we're going to close it up this week. I'm off for a couple of days next week, going on a cruise with the fam. Going to spend some time doing circles around the Bahamas in the terrible weather that it looks like it's going to be. But I'm sure we'll have a good time nonetheless. Playing bingo, and there's an escape room on this boat, and there's a water slide, and there's all sorts of fun things going on. I hope you have a wonderful Christmas. Hanukkah that starts in a couple of days. And you really spend some time with your family. Do some reflection. Create those resolutions. Write them down. Do the plan. Do the work. It's all a process. And if you do it right, you're going to be a success. I know it. I want to thank you so much for being a part of this. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you on the other side. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.